Steven. Radio. Everyone, welcome to episode 2 of Steven LeBron Radio. I'm your host, Alex. For any new listeners or returning listeners, if you haven't seen all the tweets and Facebook updates that I've been sending about the podcast last week, I'm happy to let you know that the podcast is now available for subscription on iTunes. You can go to my blog, stevenlebron.com, click on subscribe to podcast on the sidebar, or if you're listening in iTunes, just go to the podcast tab in the iTunes store and search for Steven LeBron Radio. And as always, feedback is welcomed. You can find me on Twitter at Steven_LeBron. Now for today's episode, I'm happy to have two guests with me. And before I introduce them, I want to talk a little bit about the project that they've been working on, or they finished and is now promoting on Kickstarter. The reason that why I discovered these people and have them with me today. They've been working on a documentary called Nine Man, which is a streetball game played in Chinatown by Chinese-American and Chinese-Canadian men. And its origins date back to all the way to the 1930s. Now, there's some key words in there, Chinese, men, because this game is only played by men, and two-thirds of the players have to be 100% Chinese. Now, the best way to describe the game is to quote Nine Man's Kickstarter page, is imagine volleyball with 18 guys, dunks, and bloody elbows. I watched the trailer to this documentary, I was fascinated, and one of the quotes that really captured me on the Kickstarter page was that this film was an opportunity to show Asian American athletes without the filter of mainstream misconception. So I'm happy to have director of the film, Ursula Liang, and producer Teresa Navarro to be on the show with me. Hello everyone.
Hi Alex, thanks for having us on.
Hi everybody.
No problem. Now, before we start getting into questions about yourself and obviously this documentary, maybe just tell the listeners about how they can sort of read and find out more about this documentary online.
Well, the most information is online through our Kickstarter page right now. If you go to Kickstarter.com and put in 9-man, you will find a page with a little video of me describing sort of the project in short form and then a long written description. We also have a website, which is www.9-man.com, where you can sign up for updates. There's not a lot on that website right now, but there will be eventually when we have money to pay the web developer to add stuff to it. And you can help us by contributing at Kickstarter so we can do that and get more information up. And there's also a Facebook page. You go to facebook.com/9mandoc, and we're posting all the time up in there about the documentary, but a lot more about Asians in sports, Chinese Americans, some Chinese in documentary stuff. And then you can also go to YouTube and search Nine Man and find out information about the sport in general.
And then we try to also keep updates on them. We're pretty active on Twitter as well as on Tumblr, and our handles there are Nine Man Doc. And then just a little clarification, the Kickstarter is actually for post-production. We're not done yet, but the Kickstarter is actually to help us get there. So.
Perfect. Now, maybe we'll start with Ursula, and Teresa, you can chime in as well. Tell me a little bit sort of about yourself, your writing, sort of directing, producing careers, and any sort of your personal sports interests.
Well, I'm a new person in the world of video. I was a longtime magazine journalist, and as I sort of saw the world of print journalism taking a little bit of a nosedive, I decided that I wanted to add some multimedia skills and started to teach myself how to shoot and work in the film and television space. So actually Nine Man was the first project I started working on when I wanted to do more video stuff, but I was doing that sort of on the side as I was teaching myself stuff. And in the meantime, I've added on some skills and started working on a couple television shows and worked as a producer on a few other documentaries. One was Wo Ai Ni Mami, which is a story about a Chinese person being adopted from China at the age of 8 and coming to the U.S. and living with a Jewish family in Long Island. And the other one is Fighting Foster, which is a story about, in part, a Bangladeshi woman who has lost her kids to the foster care system and tries to get them back. And then I also work on a couple UFC TV shows. So I work as a field producer and a story producer on those.
Perfect. And you play any sports during your free time?
Right now I'm playing basketball. I just picked up basketball because I'm getting older and I feel like I need a sport that has me running more. But for a long time I was a volleyball player, and I have like two torn rotator cuffs now that I'm really stubborn about not rehabbing. So it would take like a huge Herculean effort for me to get back into playing volleyball and rehabbing. But that's my main sport. And yeah. I did grow up playing a lot of different sports, but volleyball was the main one.
Yeah, I hear you on the rehab. I broke my ankle a couple of years ago playing basketball, and I think I was supposed to do physio for 3 months. I think I did it for 3 days. And Teresa, a little bit about yourself as well.
Sure. So I really kind of started my career in Asian American media. So I was working for a nonprofit media arts organization in the San Francisco Bay Area. That's really part of the National Minority Consortium, along with other organizations like Pacific Islanders in Communications, who kind of work to make sure that there are more and healthier images of people of color on public television. And part of that meant that I worked specifically for an Asian American film festival, one of the biggest in the country, that was based in San Francisco. And I got to interface a lot with different filmmakers, both, narrative, feature length. I helped curate short film festivals and exhibitions in different spaces. And then I went on to kind of work alongside other Asian American film festivals to help promote filmmakers that would get into Sundance that were of Asian or Asian American descent. After that, I kind of got into a little bit of acting with several independent narrative feature films with filmmakers like H.P. Mendoza and Rich Wong, who are both based out of San Francisco. They're both kind of known for a big indie musical called Coma the Musical. And then over the last year, my work with them kind of evolved into producing specifically the recent feature film, Yes, We're Open, and then also Daylight Savings, which is the sequel to Surrogate Valentine. And then after moving to New York, several of the people that I worked with on the last film had also worked on Ursula's film. So we connected, and I was super excited. I mean, the story is so compelling. I'm a big sports buff as well. So to kind of work on this, and, you know, I'm dating a Chinese-American dude. And I was like, you know, I love Chinese-American dudes. So let's get together and make this film so we can promote that, yeah.
If you go on Instagram or Twitter and search the hashtag Chinese dudes, you will find lots of posts from Teresa. She loves Chinese dudes.
Is this safe for work or not safe for work?
Safe for work.
Okay.
Nudie pictures, yes.
No, she's working up to that.
Okay, well, I'm just checking. Now, I swear we're going to get into the documentary. I didn't scam you guys to come on just to talk about Chinese dudes, hashtag. But Ursula, I'm reading profile of you online, and it says that among your favorite exploits is attending prom with an NBA draft pick and shopping in a Texas mall with Yao Ming and Wang Zhiji. Can you just tell me a little bit about both?
Yeah, I had a lot of fun times working as a sports journalist, and I sort of word that very carefully because I actually did go to the prom with Kendrick Perkins when he was his senior year of high school, but his date was not me. His date was like the valedictorian of the class, and she was like a super sweet girl. I was there for a story for ESPN Magazine, and I've sort of followed the whole day of him preparing and trying to find like some cubic zirconia earrings and like getting the limos all together, and it was like a really fun time, and he's a really sweet guy, so I enjoyed that story. It was fun and quirky.
So the perception that most people have of Perkins and how he is on the court isn't really how he is in real life then?
Well, I saw him before he became an NBA player, and I know that like fame and the pressures of all that affects people, and I haven't spent any time with him since, but he really, like, I was surprised that he was like really like a perfect Southern gentleman. I was surprised that that his girlfriend was sort of like the most wholesome of all the people in the school. I mean, she was a valedictorian. She had like a very reasonable, like pretty and conservative dress. She was nice. She wasn't like, you know, she just was like one of the stereotype of an NBA girlfriend. And she was like respectable girl. And he was a perfectly nice guy. And he was surrounded by a really nice group of friends. So that's my impression of him. And I'll stay with that one until I see him again and he proves otherwise.
Perfect. And shopping in the Texas mall with Yao and Wang Zhiji.
Yeah, the Mavericks had brought out a whole bunch of, well, I think they brought like the entire Chinese national team before they took Wang Zhiji. So they had a whole bunch of Chinese basketball players, and they've been really smart about developing relationships with China and the players over there. And so I happened to be doing a story. I think I was doing a story about Wang Zhizhi coming to the team, but maybe it was before that even. I was just out there with the team and following them around, and they were doing things like, it is just funny to see Chinese people experiencing America. I mean, we're Chinese Americans. We're not the same as Chinese. And when they come here, like they were like going to Walmart and looking for like fish oil tablets, and like they thought the prices here were really cheap for fish oil tablets. And Yao Ming was, we were at the mall and Yao Ming was wandering around looking for underwear. So he was being like a little not interactive with me because I thought it was like a language barrier, but actually it was probably because I was a girl like following them around and he was like looking for underwear.
Yeah, that must have been a little uncomfortable from this.
Funny personal photos that I took. There's one of him, like we stopped somewhere and he like played the claw machine, you know, the one that like reaches in and grabs like a stuffed animal. And the picture that I have of him is really funny because he's so tall that playing the claw machine, he was literally bent in half, you know, like angle in order to move the controls to play the claw machine. And then you have another really funny one of him, because when they were at the mall, when they went to get something to eat, they didn't go to McDonald's like you might expect them doing in America, but they went to the Panda Express. So I just thought the Panda Express, which I think is really funny too.
Actually, my friend is Chinese American and he loves Panda Express. I don't know why.
I'll eat Chinese food of any form and any quality anytime. So
I might have to work on a sponsorship after that.
Panda Express.
Download.
So let's get into this documentary then. This is your project, so I'm gonna just kind of let you speak on it. Tell me a little bit maybe about the origin of the Nine Man Game, and explain to listeners about the history and sort of a little bit, maybe a little more detail into how the game works.
Well, the game has its roots in Toisan, China. Like a huge majority of the people that came to the U.S. and Canada originally were from Toisan, which is southern China, a province that's like about an hour and a half away from Guangzhou. And I believe that volleyball of some sort was brought over to China by missionaries. And in China, they believe that the birthplace of volleyball in the entire world is Toisan. So most of the people that were in the U.S. early on were from that area, and they were living in a world that was really unfriendly to them. It was almost exclusively men. They call it sort of a bachelorhood society because in the 1880s, there was a law that was put into place that stopped the Chinese laborers who had come over here to work jobs from bringing their families over. So there was this class of men that were here without women. At some point, it was like, you know, 300 men to one woman in the Chinese community. And I think in the 1930s, it was probably more like 4 to 1, but it was like an almost all male society. And the guys worked incessantly. They were working in jobs like laundries and restaurants, and those places stayed open all the time. And they only had basically one day off per year, and that was Labor Day. And so I sort of put the roots of my film in the 1930s, the late 1930s, because that's when they started organizing and making a tournament out of this game that they played from back home. So in the 1930s, they started a tournament that traveled originally between like Boston and Rhode Island, and then spawned even further and began to connect all the major Chinatowns. And guys were living, you know, really tough lives, working really hard. They were really isolated from mainstream, quote, white, you know, society. And there were not very many opportunities for guys. So part of the tournament was social and like recreational release. But part of it was also, they keep telling me that they were doing like reconnaissance. Yeah, mm-hmm. Reconnaissance. Whatever it is where you go and like try to figure out what's happening in another city. They were trying to figure out whether guys in other Chinatowns were getting along okay, whether the community was surviving there, whether it might be an opportunity to go move to another city because maybe the opportunities for Chinese were better in another city. So it started as an all-Chinese tournament because that's the way it was. You weren't socializing with people of other colors at that time, and there were only men. So these Chinese men got together, and they played the sport they knew from home. In all my descriptions of the sport, I describe it as like an exclusively Chinese American sport because the rules that they started out right with then morphed a little bit. But what's happened in other parts of the world is that the game has morphed so much that it is no longer what they're playing here in America. So it's sort of this interesting phenomenon of immigrants where the people that came to this country preserved the culture as they knew it from the time at which they immigrated. And, you know, other places like back in China, the game has changed. It's modernized. It's basically volleyball now. Sometimes it's volleyball with nine people, but the game that is played here in the U.S. by like guys in their 20s and 30s is exactly like they played in the 30s. In the 1930s. They've kept the rules in place and haven't changed a bit because they see this as part of like an important part of their cultural heritage. So, that's sort of the basic roots of the game. And over time, the game has become much more competitive. The game has grown to expand and include many other cities. So most of the major Chinatowns are represented in the tournaments, and the tournament actually travels between the different cities. So every year there's a mini tournament in the heart of New York's Chinatown, but there's a national tournament every Labor Day that goes between the Chinatowns. Next year it will be in D.C. Last year it was in Toronto. The year before was Montreal. It was Boston.
Was it in Toronto at the Metro Convention Center?
Yeah. So one of the things, the tournament has gotten so big that in some of the cities where they want to play, they can't find enough street space or parking space that the city will allow them to take over for the tournament. So we're talking about a couple thousand people playing at once. And so they did it this year at the Metro Center in Toronto, which does have like the traditional cement flooring, which, you know, it's,
yeah, I live right across from there.
Yeah. So they did it at the convention center, and it's funny because like the way they set up the nets is like really, for lack of a better or more PC word, is really ghetto. Like they sometimes are rolling over like cars on top of the ropes that hold the nets up, and sometimes they have like water buckets filled, you know, huge buckets filled with water in order to weigh down parts of the nets and like pallets and stuff like that. So they brought all that stuff like into the convention center and tried to set it up within. And the convention center in Toronto is actually fairly close to Chinatown. So I think in making the tournament nowadays is it's social, it's athletic, it's cultural, but it's also an opportunity to bring business to Chinatown. And the convention center was close enough to walk to Chinatown. And so that the tournament itself and this influx of Chinese Americans and Chinese Canadians would bring a lot of business to Chinatown.
Right. Now, I know that the game is very, from what I've read about it, it seems, I guess, very exclusive kind of to within the Chinese community. And do you think that's one of the main reasons or the reason why this is kind of a lesser known story and not too many people, including myself, really knew about it until reading about your project?
I mean, I don't know. I think one of the problems is that, people don't know sports well enough, and they think that when they walk by it that it's volleyball. Mm-hmm. I'm a volleyball player, so the second I see nine people on one side, I know something is wrong.
Right.
So, you know, people casually are walking by and thinking people are playing volleyball, and that's a mistake because I think the games are entirely different. And if you ask anybody who plays volleyball, even on a casual level, and especially the people who play on an elite level, it's an entirely different game. But I do think that exclusivity has something to do with it. And I think, you know, at a certain point, isolation of these Chinese men playing the sport was not an option. They were forced to be part of their own community because nobody else would have them. And it's such like the guys that play it love, there's something really special. Like when you walk into the scene, it's like there's like, this energy that's really like palatable and palpable. And you can really feel it. And the guys like love what they're doing so much. They love the key they form so much that I think that they want to hold on to that and keep it, you know, keep it for themselves in some way. I don't know. But yeah, the rule is that 2/3 of the people on the court have to be, I put this in air quotes, 100% Chinese. That means that to most people that they have two parents who are of Chinese origin. And the other people on the court have to be part Asian, and Asian is defined in very specific ways. It does not include Indian. It does include, I don't think it includes like Samoans. There's some very specific people that are left off the list that would by most like government definitions qualify as Asian Canadian or Asian American. For a lot of the guys, this is a way to preserve some of the unique attributes of the tournament, sort of the feel of it, the Chineseness of it, sort of the cultural heritage. And it's also a way, I think, to control the numbers and the competition a little bit.
Interesting thing, talking to Ursula and finding out more about this project is that, that initially it was really truly exclusively in Chinatown and Chinese communities, but now a lot of the folks that are coming back are actually returning to Chinatown. They might not necessarily have grown up in Chinatown, but then there's an opportunity to kind of reclaim this idea of their culture, their heritage, through this, kind of tradition that isn't really how it's played even in the original origin or original space. So
yeah, I mean, Chinatown like used to be where all the Chinese people lived, but now Chinatown, it doesn't really exist in the same way in a lot of cities. Like the Chinese people have moved out to the suburbs. They're living in white neighborhoods, black neighborhoods. It's like the diaspora has grown so far away, and the practices that people do for Nine Man and the tournaments that bring them back into Chinatown are like a valuable way to reconnect the community. And I guess like, and I'd say that that's sort of my perspective. I grew up in Newton, Massachusetts, which is a white suburb next to Boston. There's a partner women's tournament that goes along with it that's just volleyball. So what the men are playing is very specific and special. There's an element that was added in the 70s where the tournament includes six women volleyball. And so I ended up playing six women volleyball as part of this tournament. And for me, it was an opportunity to reconnect with my Chinese roots and to be in Chinatown in a way that I'd never been before.
Perfect. Now, I know that you mentioned on your Kickstarter page that you first found out about the game because your brother started playing in the 90s. I want to know whether he's still playing now, and also if you can kind of lead in then with that into sort of when you started researching on the project and kind of how this everything came about, like how long has this project been going on since you began, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, my brother started playing at the same year that I started playing. I actually started playing first, and then I realized that there were guys that he knew from playing like sort of elite level volleyball in Massachusetts, and they invited him in to a club. You kind of have to be invited to be on a lot of these clubs. So he's 40 now with two kids, and he has retired from playing volleyball. I think he's got the same sort of shoulder problems I have, but he had quite a lot of fun playing. And I think one of the main reasons he's not playing in the tournament is also that he moved from Boston. He started playing in Boston with the Boston Knights, and it's a very close-knit group of guys, and he sort of, you know, that became his family at a certain point. And there is, for some teams, there's a little bit of like a taboo against jumping from team to team. And so he moved away and didn't feel like he could, you know, without practicing all the time and not being with the team all the time, he didn't feel like he could play in the national tournament, even though he was good enough to play. And he didn't want to jump to another team. I, on the other hand, like I played for a team in Boston, and then I moved to New York and I played for a team in New York. I had a complete drifter.
No loyalty.
I know. It's the difference between me and my brother, I guess. But I mean, I just sort of felt like, you know, I wanted to play, and I wasn't going to move back. I wasn't going to move back home to play. So, the origins of the project, I always thought it was really interesting. And my brother, you know, the sport is super interesting. I learned a little bit more about it. I was playing at the time, so, like, I didn't get to know the sport as quickly as I could have because I was doing my own thing. I wasn't sitting there watching the guys. But one of the things I always enjoyed was that the guys had like this swag that I really don't see represented in the mainstream media. Like you and I know that like there's all kinds of different personalities and phenotypes in the Chinese American community, but the ones you see on TV are pretty monotone. Mm-hmm. And like I liked that they were all tall, you know, not all of them are tall, but you know, like that some of them were tall and some of them had muscles and some of them had attitude, and like this was like an image of Asian American men that I thought needed to be shown. And at the time I was working, maybe I was working at ESPN magazine at that time, but I was really early in my career, and you know, mainstream media doesn't do a lot of stuff about alternative sports. You know, they do the main four, and it's really hard to get stories into like a magazine space, especially about niche sports. And so I was also too young in my career to really like demand it or to push that I write like a long feature. I didn't think it was like a little 200-word piece. I thought it was like a complicated and interesting story. So I was always interested in telling a story about it. But the tournament travels from year to year. So like every, you know, 6, 7, 8 years, it travels to the same city. It makes like a full circuit. And so I had played in New York. It came back around in New York, like, I don't know if it was two cycles later or one cycle later. It was either like 6 or 12 years later. And I was thinking about it again, and I realized, like, there's still no one has told the story. No other reporter in, like, 6 or 12 years has told this story. Like, no documentary has been made. No major articles have been written. I was like, this is sort of ridiculous. And at that time, I wasn't working in sports anymore. I wasn't really doing the same thing, but I thought it was, like kind of a crime that no one had covered it yet. And then I started thinking about it more. I started looking into the roots and reading up a little bit, and I realized that at the time when I started looking at the project as maybe something that I had to do, that the guys that had been pioneers in the sport, the oldest people that we sort of had on record as playing in the early days were in the 90s. And so then I felt like, okay, you know, I could wait and try to talk someone else into doing it. I could wait and do it later. But the main, you know, to me, it was really, really important to lock the story down and have these old guys on camera, because you never know what's going to happen. Like, you never know tomorrow has. So, so I first started, I think, I don't know, this might have been 2008. I started trying to track down the old guys. It might have been early. Yeah, it might have been 2008. Started tracking down the old guys. I also felt like, you know, when you're working on an indie project, it's hard to have the money to do all the things in the way that you want to do them. And so I figured, like, listen, if I, this is really kind of devious of me, but like, if I get these old guys and then one of them dies, then no one else has the story that I have. Even if ESPN comes in and wants to do the story, even if HBO Sports wants to come in and do the story, like, I'll have the piece of the story that sort of is priceless. So, that was my goal, is to get the old guys on record. And I did, and it was super interesting, and then I just sort of kept going from there.
Right. So from 2008, I guess, would it be all the way up to, I guess, this year was when you kind of completed getting the footage and the interviews and all of that you needed for the documentary?
I wasn't done yet. I mean, part of what you do in the documentary process is you, like, edit down and then you go back out and see what you need. And, like, you know, working on this a lot, I shot almost all of it myself. I mean, I had a lot of help at tournaments and stuff, but during the, you know, the more intimate moments at home and stuff like that, I was shooting and doing sound by myself, and didn't have any producer on the project at the time. So there are definitely a lot of holes in the story that you need to fill later on. So we filmed, like, most aggressively in 2010. I filmed some more the next couple of years, like, just trying to fill in things that I thought, like, I could kind of cheat into the timeline. And then when we edit it down and we realize, like, what we need, we'll go back out and shoot a few more things. So right now we're sort of in an editing stage and are sort of shaping the story. There's also most of the guys that play are Chinese American or Chinese Canadian. They speak English, very, like, Americanized or Canadianized. And there's a couple teams though that are FOBs and speak Choisan. And so we, you know, they're kind of like a fun team, and we followed them around a bit, but we didn't translate the footage, and no one in our crew, like, one spoke Cantonese, which is kind of close, but no one, there's still some footage we need to translate, and there are some interviews that I want to do in Choisanese based on that footage. So, like, there's some stuff I definitely know I need to go back out and get.
So if any of your listeners can speak Choisanese, yeah, we would definitely love you to contact us.
Yeah, if anyone speaks Choisan, like, I mean, I know a ton of these guys speak Choisan, but I would like someone from outside the community to help, because it's better to have someone not involved with the community to help give us a little bit of an outside perspective.
And I think, I mean, when we started talking about that aspect of it, it was to the twist, because that's, okay, the whole kind of purview of this has been the idea that this is a way for people to keep it traditional, like Chinese Americans or Chinese Canadians, to maintain a particular tradition. And then there's, like, a new level of immigrants, because there's always going to be people immigrating here, and so it kind of comes full circle almost again, you know. So it's really, I think that's really interesting, and hopefully it's interesting, you know, when people are watching this, it's not just about you being Chinese American and watching this and seeing a slice of the history that you may or may not have access to, but first and foremost, it's a sports tournament. Like, it's a sports story, you know, and I think that's what's the most, me, I'm not Chinese American, I'm Filipino American, but, you know, I grew up in areas that were predominantly, predominantly Asian American. All of my friends' parents had immigrated here. So we kind of have this sense of camaraderie, you know, like, navigating this world together as kind of first generation, first 1.5 second generation folks. So I think that's kind of where I feel like this is such an accessible story, because, you know, you're talking about building a community over something like sports. The level of competition and the level of intensity that you're seeing in a lot of this footage is, like, you're literally not going to see anywhere else. So.
Perfect. Now, do you see this game, I guess, carrying on to future generations, like, from, I guess, what you know about it? Is it being sort of passed down, or is it something that might kind of go away as we move?
I think that, you know, guys are always afraid that it's going to go away. The guys in the tournament, they're always afraid to retire because they don't think, like, you know, the next guy can lead the team, or the team might fall apart. But there are so many people that are committed to this and committed to the community that I don't think it's dying anytime soon. I mean, this year or last year, I found out that there's a team in Boston where they are, like, teaching kids, like, 5 years old to play. And, really cute. They actually even put them in, like, a little mini tournament at some point, and they're playing, you know, these little tiny kids, you know, 5 to, like, 12 or whatever, were playing up against some regular sized human beings, like, in their 20s and 30s. And it's just kind of fun. And I don't see it dying out at all.
Okay. Now, one of the things that you had mentioned was that this documentary would kind of showcase, I guess, Asian Americans, or especially Asian American athletes, from a different perspective. And I wanted to ask you, because you had mentioned on your Kickstarter page, one of the quotes is that mainstream sports coverage is not always friendly to Asian athletes, and there's long-held ideas that Asian athletes are inherently inferior. Want to know from, I guess, your personal experience, whether there's anything specific or from anything that you've covered, if you have an example of when you felt this, or why do you feel this way?
Well, we can talk about the most recent example. Jeremy Lin is a really classic example. I mean, I don't know if you've talked about this on your
Yeah, there's actually a running joke, because I've been on other podcasts, and the first podcast that I did under this brand name, that I always need a mandatory 10 minutes on Jeremy Lin. So this is perfect. Go on.
You set me up for it. I'm setting you up.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, he's deceptively quick, stuff like that. That's, there are beliefs which are disproven by so much scientific data, but keep coming back up. You know, people keep trying to prove in science that there are racial differences in sports, and there are people in science who keep disproving that as well. That kind of stuff comes up all the time. Sometimes it's subtle, and sometimes it's really blatant. Even one of the guys I interviewed for the documentary, who happens to be a personal trainer, told me that, you know, I asked him sort of about those things and whether he believed in that. And I think sometimes Asian athletes themselves believe in some of that stuff. And he told me that he read in, like, Muscle Magazine, not to point out a particular publication because I don't remember the name of it, but it, like, a Muscle Magazine of some sort. You know, there was, like, a very scientific breakdown of the differences in physical abilities of different races. And this was something that was being, like, you know, sort of laid out in order for him as a trainer to be able to train people in different ways, because they are so different and so differently, you know, so different in their potential abilities to do anything athletic. I'm having trouble coming up with another specific example, but it's just like there all the time. I mean, I guess long ago, before, you know, maybe like 15 years ago, it was really hard to get any coverage about Asian Americans, because people believed that people weren't interested in Asian Americans. So at the time of like Dot Nguyen and such, like, who's a phenomenal player, people didn't want to put him on the cover. People didn't want to write long articles about him. They didn't think that was something that the general public would be interested in seeing. I did a panel recently on Jeremy Lin at the Museum of Chinese America in New York City, and the editors of GQ were there. And as you probably know, that Jeremy Lin was on the cover of GQ in both China edition and the US edition. Mm-hmm. You know, I talked to the editor, and I was like, I need to know, like, what was that discussion like in the, you know, story idea room? Did people actually have, any kind of thoughts that this was a bad idea to put him on the cover? Because that's the discussion that I heard in many different places, that, you know, Asian American athletes in particular can't sell, because that's sort of the bottom line when you're talking about media, that you're actually trying to sell a product. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, it was really nice to hear that that was not a question had they had at all. They sort of assumed that it would sell really, really well, and I believe it has. So we've come pretty far. But then again, you know, just last, you know, probably in today's paper, there's something about Jeremy Lin that is a little bit off if you're Asian American and you're reading it.
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, I think the Jeremy Lin, the whole phenomenon when it happened in New York, like, sometimes I feel like when Asian athletes sort of explode onto the mainstream, and obviously there's probably only a handful of examples, I feel like sometimes it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, because for someone like me, Asian Canadian, like, obviously I was very in tune into the Jeremy Lin story from a personal perspective, and I wanted him to do well just for my own reasons, beyond just rooting for the Knicks. I'm not a Knicks fan, or just rooting for a good sports story. And I really want to get to a point where when an Asian athlete does good, it just gets treated the same way as any other, a white, black, or any other color athlete. And it doesn't sort of explode into all these different conversations. Like, that's what I hope that we can one day get to. That,
well, we need so that that happens, yeah. I think, you know.
Yeah.
Once it's sort of the status quo, then we can just blend in some other kind of fashion.
Right. Well, I think that'll wrap it up. Before we go, if you want to tell the listeners a little bit about sort of the different Kickstarter reward levels and the things that are available to them should they donate.
Well, Kickstarter.com, search for 9-man, and you will find us. We're also on the most popular page because people have been really pitching in, and it's one of our goals is to actually, we think we'll meet our financial goal in the Kickstarter, and you have to meet it in order to get any money at all, because if you don't raise your minimum, then the money goes back to everybody who contributed. But we're really interested in sort of gathering an army of people who are interested in seeing the film, because like I said before, people are not sure that Asian American athletes are a topic that people care about. And I've been really excited to see through the Kickstarter campaign that a whole bunch of people, not just like Asian American men, are interested in the story. So the more people we have that contribute just like a dollar,
yep,
that bring up our numbers, that we show to people at film festivals, that we can show to people who give out grants, that you know, we can prove that this is a story that people want to hear. And so we're trying to get our numbers up. We have a lot of different things that you can get. I mean, we'll give you like shout outs of all kinds, just if you give us a dollar on the Kickstarter pledge. But we're also doing a few cool things.
Yeah, Ursula has all these, there's these really great ideas that we had even before kind of really conceptualizing Kickstarter. One of them is a really unique guide to Chinatowns based on where Nine Men players like to eat. So it's a really cool kind of digital map really of different Chinatowns that Ursula's compiling. And then there's this, I think one of my favorite rewards at least is the Nine Men trading cards. So this whole concept of kind of like, you know, the legacy and history where you have of all the teams that we kind of are in contact with are going to help vote some of the most historical players that they want to memorialize on a card. So that's going to be really cool. And of course, the digital download of the film. There's even rewards as high as, going to a special dim sum, you know, breakfast with the
director. If you like hearing us talk, you could have this talk in your ear at, like, with dim sum, with me and Teresa sitting at your side. She can be on the left, I'll be on the right, and we will have some really good dim sum. You could also... We also have like our grand prize contribution. You could be the executive producer of the film if you really want to be down with Nine Man. So please check out the Kickstarter page and contribute if you can. If nothing more, please share it on your Facebook. A lot of our word of mouth is really, really helping the campaign and the film. So
interestingly, one of the more popular ones is a special $88 one. It's like very, very good luck. I don't know why. There's a
lucky
lot of people. Yeah, there's people coming out of the $88 one, and I was like, that's so funny. I mean, it's so, because it's,
That is pretty funny. Okay, thank you, Ursula, Teresa, for doing this, and best of luck to the project.
Thank you so much for having us on.